Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center, and she's an internationally recognized clinician and clinical researcher. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, and Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilo. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the most recent advances in the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. May is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and this week you'll hear a conversation about these tumors with Dr. Jennifer Moliterno-Gunnell. Dr. Moliterno is Assistant Professor of Neurosurgery at Yale School of Medicine, and here's Anish Chagpar.
Jen, you recently joined Yale, and you specialize in neurosurgery and particularly in the surgical treatment of brain tumors. Talk a little bit about what it is that you do and what makes your particular brand of brain surgery unique.
So, I'm trained as a general neurosurgeon here at Yale, and while I was training, I really developed a passion for helping people with brain tumors. And so I subsequently went to Memorial Sloan Kettering for specialized fellowship training in the surgical treatment of brain tumors and spinal cord tumors. And so building my practice here on my return to Yale, I've really been focused on brain tumors primarily. I see all types of patients with all types of brain tumors, whether it's primary, originating in the brain, whether it's secondary, meaning metastatic from other locations in the body, benign tumors, malignant tumors, etc. And so what really is special about it, I think, is the patient population. These are people who tend to be very scared when they get the diagnosis of a brain tumor, understandably so. And it's really been an honor and a privilege to work with people.
Hmm. Do you always know ahead of time before your surgery if it's going to be a benign tumor or a malignant tumor that you're operating on?
We have a pretty good idea based on MRI. There are certain characteristics that would suggest a tumor being benign versus malignant. Sometimes the location of the tumor helps us as well, but we often have a good idea.
So, you know, most people, and I respect the fact that you're a brain surgeon, kind of like a rocket scientist, you have powers that most of us don't. But for a lot of people, we really think of our brains as being vital structures that we don't particularly want somebody going in and taking big pieces out of. So how is it that you can take out a piece of somebody's brain and still have them be
normal.
Somewhat normal and functional afterwards?
No, they're very normal and functional. And you know, what I always tell my patients is that I'm not doing this because I want to do this. I'm not doing this because they want me to do this. This is something that we're both faced with. This is a situation that we're faced with that we have to intervene. And so typically what happens with tumors, whether the tumor is pushing on the brain or arising in the brain, usually that area of brain is already being disrupted by the tumor. If the tumor is on the outside of the brain pushing in, often we can go in and remove the tumor and we can relieve the pressure off of the brain. And so whatever function was being diminished by the pressure caused by the brain, we're usually able to get that back and get the patient back to their baseline. For the tumors that arise in the brain themselves or are in what we call the brain parenchyma, which is within the brain itself, that makes it a little bit more tricky to restore function because, again, the tumor itself has already distorted the function of the brain. So we're not exactly going in there and we're not removing normal tissue. We're removing abnormal tissue.
How do people know or suspect they have a brain tumor? I mean, it seems so scary.
It is scary. And so, and people get worried too. I see patients all the time who have headaches that are completely unrelated.
I can never remember the name of somebody I met yesterday. should I be worried?
Well, we can scan you after. No, you know, and that's the whole that's the whole trick with doing neurosurgical oncology, is knowing when a brain tumor is symptomatic and when a patient is symptomatic. And so oftentimes we'll see patients, usually by the time they get to me, we've established the diagnosis of a brain tumor. And so whatever symptoms they have are likely related to the brain tumor. But of course, patients will have headaches, and headaches can be very, as you know, nondescript. And, you know, a lot of people have headaches, and they can be completely unrelated. The headaches that people usually get worried about, physicians usually get worried about, if there's a change in the type of headache that the person usually has, if there's a change in that, or if there's headaches that are worsening in terms of intensity or severity, frequency, just won't go away, that sort of thing. That's what really prompts getting a workup. In addition, there can also be focal neurological deficits. That's what we call them, that can be associated with tumors. So, for instance, if there's a tumor that's pushing on the eye nerve, patients might present with visual loss or issues with visual acuity. If there's a tumor that's involving the motor aspects of the brain, they might present with weakness. And so I think it's important, especially with signs and symptoms such as those, to really seek medical attention.
That sounds a lot like a stroke.
Exactly. And so a lot of times, it's more often than not, patients will go to the emergency room, or they'll see their primary care doctor because they're concerned that they're having a stroke. And indeed, it turns out that they actually have a brain tumor.
Hmm.
So let's suppose somebody has a headache and they go and they see their doctor and the headache has been changing and they're worked up and lo and behold, they have a brain tumor. What strikes me about brain tumors is that it's housed within your skull.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that you can feel. So as a breast cancer surgeon, you know, sometimes I can feel these cancers.
Sure.
And I know where they are. And if I don't know where they are, I can use imaging to find where they are and take out the cancer. So how do you exactly know where this thing is when you're in the operating room?
So we do a lot of legwork before we even get to the operating room. So as you were saying, sometimes patients will present with a headache, or they'll present with what you were saying, you know, you can't remember what you did yesterday or something like that. And so we have to then look at the imaging, see where the tumor is, and decide, are they related? You know, is the patient symptomatic? Sometimes tumors can be found incidentally, but they could appear to be more malignant, or they could be very large in size. And then we'll opt to do surgery, you know, regardless of whether or not they're symptomatic. We then do imaging, and usually it just involves a regular MRI with and without contrast, and it can help localize where the tumor is. Based on the location of the tumor, then we can decide our operative plan, and there's certain aspects that go into consideration. We can start out with something that's more minimal in terms of just getting a diagnosis, which would be a brain biopsy, which is usually reserved for cases of tumors that are located in very, very deep locations that are very difficult to access, and that we would be concerned doing a larger surgery, such as tumor removal, would really result in problems for the patient. It's pretty rare, though. The other aspect of it is there can sometimes be tumors that are located in more what we call eloquent areas of the brain, and those are areas of the brain that are very important in function, such as motor or speech. And once we think that we're dealing with a tumor that's in one of those eloquent areas of the brain, we can get further studies and further imaging to help assess us whether or not we can go ahead and resect the tumor as much as possible. That study that I'm talking about is a functional MRI, which is a special MRI, which then shows us actually the function of the brain and the functional areas of the brain. And it involves the patient interacting with a radiologist and a team during the actual MRI. And then that imaging gives me information as to where the tumor is relative to those functional areas.
Hmm.
And so it's not uncommon that Patients will see some surgeons that would be concerned that tumors would be near or within eloquent areas of the brain and would just offer a biopsy. But here at Yale, we tend to be as aggressive as possible because the extent of tumor resection has been shown to be associated with improved outcomes.
So how do you be as aggressive as possible without hurting those functional areas?
Exactly. And so that's what all the training is about. So sometimes what we need to do, and in one area of neurosurgery that I have really specialized in and focus on, is doing awake craniotomies. And so when I see a patient who has a tumor that's in a very functional area, again, speech or motor is typically the most common, sometimes we will need the patient to be awake during surgery, not the entire surgery, but part of the surgery. And part of deciding whether or not to do an awake craniotomy is really to know if it's necessary or not, because it obviously can be very stressful for the patient. But we have protocols here to make it absolutely as comfortable as possible.
So is it painful because they're awake?
So, and that's what, you know, the patients always say. So again, once we decide that it's indicated, and the reason that we do it again is to maximize the extent of resection, but to make sure that we're maintaining the function that we want to preserve. And so it's really not painful, and it's actually tolerated very, very well. We have a protocol here where we work with our neuroanesthesiologist and also our neuromonitoring staff, and we put the patient to sleep in the beginning. And we do, as I mentioned, a craniotomy, which is our fancy way of saying that we make an incision and take off the bone temporarily. We put it back at the end. And while we're doing that bony work, the patient is asleep, and the patient is really under anesthesia just like any other circumstance. But the beauty with the drugs that we use nowadays is that we're, as you guys know, we're able to turn them off, and the patient, within a few minutes, is able to wake up. And we make sure that we use a certain amount of local anesthetic so the patient is very comfortable and they're positioned in a comfortable way on the operating room table. And then the patient is able to interact with us during surgery.
Wow.
We're able to, once we expose the brain, we wake the patient back up and we start by stimulating the surface of the brain. And so, for instance, if it's a tumor that's located in the speech area, we'll ask them to start talking to us. Our neuromonitoring colleagues will do this part, and they'll ask them some tasks and some questions and get them talking, and we'll stimulate the brain. If we find an area of the brain that, when it's stimulated, causes speech arrest, that tells us that's an area we don't want to go, because that's the area that leads to the production of speech. And so it helps me then decide a better or safer trajectory to get to the tumor. And that's usually in an area where I don't get a response like that. Once I get down and start resecting the tumor, what we usually do is keep the patient talking. And so we ask them, you know, questions over and over again, or have them do verbal tasks, or just interact with us. And while they're speaking, I'm resecting the tumor. And so if there's ever concern, if the patient starts to slur their speech, or you know, they forget words or something like that, I stop immediately what I'm doing, and we give it, you know, some time, and we see if it was a real problem that they were beginning to have, and it allows us to push the extent of resection. It allows us to get as much tumor as safely possible, and it gives us real-time feedback that the patient is going to maintain their function.
That is very cool, being awake while your brain cancer is being taken out, so that you can really push the forefront of taking out brain cancers. We're going to talk more about some of the cool stuff that Dr. Moliterno-Gonnell is doing with brain cancers right after we take a short break for a medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about brain cancer surgery with our guest, Dr. Jennifer Moliterno-Gonnell.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2014, there'll be over 75,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, with over 1,000 of these patients living in Connecticut. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key, and when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Patients with advanced melanoma have more hope than ever before. Each day, patients are surviving the disease due to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center and at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The goal of the Specialized Programs of Research Excellence, SPOR, in skin cancer grant is to better understand the biology of skin cancer, with a focus on discovering the targets that will lead to improved diagnosis and treatment. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anish Chagpar, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Stephen Gore. Today, we're joined by our guest, Dr. Jennifer Molitano-Ganell. And I'm sure that those of you who were with us before the break remember how amazed I was, and I'm sure you were, hearing about how Dr. Molitano operates on patients while they're awake to take out their brain cancers, really enabling her to take out more cancer and preserve the functional areas. So, Jen, one of the questions I had was, all of that fancy imaging that you had before getting to the operating room, what about just using that in the operating room? Is that possible?
So it is. It unfortunately is not possible everywhere. We are very unique at Smilo Cancer Hospital that we have a 3-Tesla MRI actually in our operating room. And so it's the same type of MRI machine that they have in outpatient MRI facilities or in inpatient hospitals with the same resolution and the same imaging characteristics.
So do you have to take them off their operating table and put them into that tube that people always complain about?
So the tube or the MRI machine is actually housed in a garage. And it's in the garage is in the middle of two rooms, in two operating rooms. In one operating room, we have biplane angiography capabilities, which is just a fancy way of saying we're able to do angiograms or look at the blood vessels from the inside. And the two of those together really give us endless possibilities in terms of neurosurgery. And we're the only center, to my knowledge, in the New York and New England area that has both the biplane angiography and 3-Tesla MRI in the operating room. The other operating room that has access to the MRI only has the MRI, but the MRI is able to swing back and forth between both rooms. And so typically, what we do is, and this is, you know, with patients asleep or awake, either one, I will do the surgery. And being a brain tumor surgeon, much of as you probably know, resecting the tumor is by feel and by sight. And so you can really tell what is tumor and what is brain, and you can really feel that as well. However, with certain types of brain tumors, they can be very infiltrative into the brain. And so even under the microscope, even being a primary brain surgeon, brain tumor surgeon, it can still be difficult to tell what's normal brain and what's brain tumor. And that's where the MRI really helps. So once I get to the point that I think I've gotten the majority of the tumor out, we then bring in the MRI. We give the patient some dye. Takes about 35 minutes or so, and we can get a full series of images. We then will look at the imaging, see what, if anything, is left in terms of tumor, if it seems that it's in a safe area that I can resect, and then we will register that MRI to a navigation system, which is kind of like a GPS, and then I can go back into the surgery and pinpoint exactly where that tumor is left, even though it might look like regular brain.
Using the GPS?
Mm-hmm. We use that GPS from the start of the cases in most of our surgeries.
It's not on your cell phone, I'm assuming.
No.
So one question that I have is, you know, with the dye that you were talking about with the MRI, oftentimes that dye is in blood vessels, and you can get a blush with open blood vessels, which tend to occur with surgery. So how can you tell the difference between that's just a little bit of oozing from open blood vessels versus that's residual cancer?
So usually we can tell by comparing the different series. And so usually if we compare before the dye is given, we always take a series, an MRI series, and then we give the dye and then we take another type of series. And we actually have the capabilities of subtracting the blood vessels or the blood essentially away. And so whatever the residual enhancement is or the residual dye that we're seeing is tumor.
Hmm. Wow.
Sounds like this is very complicated and long surgery.
No, it's usually, as I said, the MRI will add on probably about 35 or 45 minutes, something like that, because, of course, we need to do our counts and make sure that the patient is safe to bring the MRI in and that sort of thing. But no, typically for, you know, a run-of-the-mill brain tumor, it usually takes us just a few hours.
So a lot of people and a lot of our listeners who have ever been in an MRI know that you can't have any metal in the MRI, you don't take your credit cards in the MRI. But people who have been in an operating room also know that there's a lot of metal that surgeons use.
There's a lot of metal.
So people may be wondering, how exactly is it that you operate in a circumstance where there's an MRI without getting all of your metal instruments
stuck to the machine?
Exactly.
Right. So that's why the MRI is housed in the garage. And so it only comes out when we want it to. But there's signs everywhere that say the MRI is always on, and it is always on. And you know, we always have to be cognizant of that. We have safety officers, actually, that are standing outside the MRI rooms all the time, guarding the rooms and checking everybody for metal going in and out. And then, of course, the metal that, you know, is in the room, as you were saying, the surgical instruments, we keep those sterile during the intraoperative MRI. And so they're just put off to the side, again, covered in sterile sheets and whatnot, but it's outside of the Gauss line, which allows it to be safe. And in terms of, you know, anesthesia, they use non-metal machine, you know, instruments and that sort of thing.
How soon after the surgery do you know how good the neurologic recovery is going to be for the patient?
Well, usually it depends. It depends on the case, and it depends where we're working. If we're working in quiet areas of the brain, usually we expect that the patient will wake up just fine. If we're working in more eloquent areas of the brain, as I mentioned, near motor or speech, there can always be swelling that's associated with surgery. But we get a pretty good gauge when the patient wakes up. You know, right there in the operating room. And, of course, sometimes patients could have a little bit of swelling, you know, after surgery that may worsen function temporarily. But how they wake up initially is usually a very good gauge.
So is this kind of surgery usually the end of the story for the patient's treatment, or do sometimes they have to interact more with radiation doctors or medical oncologists as well?
Absolutely. No, this is usually just the start, depending, of course, on the type of tumor. But we usually start out with an aggressive surgery, and then we continue with aggressive management of certain types of brain tumors. So we have a multidisciplinary tumor board that meets weekly. And so there's all physicians and then other staff, of course, who are dedicated to the treatment of brain tumors. So neurosurgeons such as myself, medical neuro-oncologists, radiation oncologists, neuropathologists, neuroradiologists, and we all come together and we discuss all the patients that we treat. I will describe the surgery, you know, what I found, what I was able to accomplish. We'll review the pathology, and then we'll make a treatment plan going from there. Of course, part of this is standard of care. So for most tumors, there's standard therapy that we give following surgery. But for other stages, there's exciting clinical trials that can be offered, and we're really on the forefront of offering those clinical trials here at Yale.
So one of the questions that people always ask, and perhaps it's less of a question but more of a statement, is that they're really afraid of clinical trials. And they say things like, I don't want to be a human guinea pig. I don't want to have human experimentation. And yet, so many of our guests really say that clinical trials are on the forefront, and that people do better on clinical trials than they would if they weren't on a clinical trial. Can you talk a little bit about clinical trials and how important they are for patients, and whether or not our patients should actually sign up for these?
Sure. I think that it's very important for patients, to understand that they're not being guinea pigs. I think that this is just looking for other ways to tackle a tumor, a difficult to treat tumor. And again, this is not with regards to all types of brain tumors. This is really the more malignant types that we're talking about. And again, there's often standard of care, and even with brain cancer, there's standard of care. But the clinical trials give different approaches or newer approaches to tackling when these tumors progress or when they recur. Sometimes the trials can also be offered upfront, meaning along with standard of care. But I think that it's very important to meet with the doctors, the neuro-oncologists, the people who run the clinical trials, and understand what exactly the trial is and how it's going after the tumor. Because they can be very effective.
Yeah.
Does this tend to be kind of one size fits all based on tumor type A looks like other tumor types A that you've seen, or are there specialized tests that can be done that can separate different patients and how their tumors may behave?
Absolutely. And so there's, of course, the variability amongst different types of brain tumors, first of all, is quite significant. And then even when we get into certain tumors, again, the malignant types of brain tumors in particular, there's such heterogeneity, there's such difference amongst one tumor compared to the other. And it's usually at a genetic level. At a mutational level within the tumor. And so another thing that we're doing here at Yale with the Yale Genome Project is sequencing these tumors and understanding the genetic mutations that are underlying. And that's one reason why certain drugs may not be effective in certain people, but effective in other people. And so ideally and ultimately, the goal will be to develop a more personalized therapeutic rationale in targeting those underlying mutations or the things that have gone wrong in tumors, and then having a more individualized therapy.
So what you're talking about is genetically sequencing the tumor itself. Is there any concept of genetically testing individuals who may be predisposed to getting brain cancers, just like there are individuals who are at increased risk of developing breast cancer? Sure. Or ovarian cancer?
There's no real, there's some syndromes, I should say, some, they're rare and very uncommon, not like breast cancer, of course, where there are a higher predisposition for having brain tumors, but they're very uncommon. Unfortunately, it just seems that there's genetic issues or mutations within the tumors themselves in randomly happening in people.
What about, you know, earlier in our discussion, you made a distinction between primary brain cancers and secondary brain cancers. And I would think that the genomic characteristics of those is different.
Mm-hmm.
And is the treatment paradigm different as well? It's one thing to resect a cancer that came from the brain itself versus one that came from another part of the body.
Yes, they're very different. The paradigms are different. The surgery even itself is different. The primary brain tumors tend to be more infiltrative throughout the normal brain, whereas the metastatic tumors or secondary tumors tend to be more encapsulated, if you would. In terms of the treatment, it's very different. The primary brain tumors rarely, or if ever, I would even say never, metastasize outside of the brain. And so it's really just dealing with the brain cancer itself and using certain drugs that are targeting that particular brain tumor. Whereas for metastatic disease, we're looking more towards treating systemically.
Dr. Jennifer Moliterno-Gonnell is Assistant Professor of Neurosurgery at the Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments with the doctors. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu or leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs from 2006 through the present are available in both audio and written versions at yalecancercenter.org/answers/archives. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support as part of the Connecting Our Communities initiative. And we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.